Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Hey everyone, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is June 30th, 2026, Tuesday, 10 a.m., and I want to thank you all so much for taking the time out of your mornings to listen to this hour of talk radio. Wherever you are, whether you're driving to work right now, whether you're at home, whether you're working from home, regardless, thank you for being here. And before we get into any of this episode of Speak Up, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are hosted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamalam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. And I just feel so eternally grateful to be able to be here on the radio speaking to all of you. All right, start off today, we have a track from a local band by the name of Sour Dope, a band that we recently had up here at the station to do a live performance as part of our Studio 6 series, where we bring in a band, could be local, could be a touring band somewhere in Canada, and we have them perform in our radio station. It goes live to air as well as up on our YouTube channel later on, and the video's up, so if you want to go to CJSF Radio's YouTube and watch that, go do it. But first, listen to this track. This one is titled Water Temple, once again, by Sour Dope. Hope you enjoy. Thank you. All right, we are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. To start off today's episode, I have a couple interviews from none other than our music coordinator here at the station, Connor Ashton, who recently attended the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo, which includes just so many people within the realm of retro video games, people who compose music aligned with retro video games and just video games in general, people who are in the business of archiving retro video games, and people such as Connor, who hosts a radio show all about video game culture, chiptune, music, things of that nature. So he was able to talk to a lot of people at the event, and some of those people agreed to be interviewed. One of those groups was the Canadian Video Game Museum. Honestly, something I had never heard of, but when I saw that Connor had interviewed them, I was like, wow, that is really cool. And they have a lot of really cool things to say and a lot of really cool things that they're working on. So please, take a listen.
And we're back. We're well underway here at the Retro Gaming Expo. This is Vancouver FM. I have a very special guest from the Canadian Video Game Museum. If you want to introduce yourself for Radioland.
Yes, hi. My name is Ryan Dunnison. I'm the founder of the Canadian Video Game Museum. We're kind of trying to incubate right now a concept of a physical video game museum for Canada. We don't have one. We're one of the top 10 countries for game development by most metrics, and we are one of the only countries in that whole list that doesn't have anything to represent that. So we're trying to set up something here in the city. And we're starting with a bunch of interactive little exhibits that we've created ourselves. I come from a game design background, so we're trying to make sure that we can gamify the process of like education in the industry. And right now we're showing a little bit of a pop-up here at the Retro Game Expo, and we will be at the end of July trying to open up a small exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver as a proof of concept.
Fantastic. Big shout out to the Museum of Vancouver. We love the crab sculpture and the planetarium. You mentioned that you're trying to engage the content in a game style itself to further the idea that like the process of learning can be a game as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is a game designer, but I've also started teaching in the game and education side of things as well. So I've been an educator at the Art Institute of Vancouver, LaSalle, and now the Center for Digital Media. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a lot of different things over the years in terms of other industries and how they've tried to educate using their own mediums. Like with film, you have documentaries. Games, we don't really have that right now. Well, there's a few bits and pieces that are starting to show up. But so we're looking at like the global landscape right now of like both what's happening in museums generally. So you're seeing these interactive exhibits like Meow Wolf and things like that. And we're also seeing that like we have this really cool medium that we can really use to teach things. And we're not seeing a lot of that happening yet. So we're hoping to kickstart a little bit of that stuff going on.
Amazing. Games as education. As someone who's been doing the show for a while, I've seen the chiptune scene and the video game scene through many years here in Vancouver. We have a lot of companies that do game development here, a couple of kind of landmark ones, as well as a ton of indie game developers. Where do you see the important part of archiving?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So, yeah, our industry is notorious at not keeping its history around because of many reasons. A lot of it comes down to acquisitions happening, and then people just don't care about the stuff that happened before, and so a lot of it gets lost. Also, like, a lot of developers hold on to their own stuff, and then it just doesn't get transferred. There's just not a good process for that. So we do see that there's a lot of these other organizations right now that are attempting to like work directly with those companies to do that. We're looking at it from a little bit of a different angle at the moment because we can see that that process isn't underway. So what we're trying to do now is like digitally archive physical objects and things like that. So we've done a lot of 3D scans of old consoles and things to hopefully be able to recreate those in the future with permissions. But it's a huge part of the problem. But not the only one. There's a lot of different things going on. Yeah.
I was talking with someone about soundtracks and how that a lot of games that we want to see a remaster or a remake of because of the rights. And it's the same thing with physical objects as well, too, because they own, you know, the schematics and the copyright to the hardware itself.
And sometimes that's split across many different companies. So what you don't necessarily always get to see is that when a company goes under or like a company gets acquired, sometimes its IPs get split. So you get things like Coleco, right? So Coleco's brand as a brand is now belonging to like one company, but the patents for like what the consoles looked like or the games or whatever could belong to like several different groups of people. So if you're trying to then get all that stuff together so that you can do a recreation of that, or a soundtrack is the same kind of problem where you have the artists and then you have the publishers and then you have the game publishers and all that kind of stuff. Getting all those people in the same room and agreeing, that becomes a really big challenge. So you even see that with like the recent Tony Hawk's games,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Where they have a few of those soundtrack pieces in there, but not the full set. And so then it becomes a question of like, did they just not try because it was just seemingly too hard, which is a possibility. But a lot of the time it's also like whoever that holder of that is at this time might have changed hands also. And then it's like, okay, but this person's less willing to work with us. How do we, yeah. So it's a challenge.
Jet Set Radio Future is the standout example for me of like, there's not a, like there's a reason why they made Bomb Rush Cyberpunk and they brought Hideki Naganuma back to write new music because they wanted that sound, but they couldn't get the rights to the Jet Set Radio Future stuff.
100%.
And then Sega itself is notorious for making something cool and then not caring about it.
Yeah, and it's not always not necessarily not caring about it. Like, as, with the Japanese companies in particular, I worked at one for a few years. Sometimes the rights are even split up within the company itself. Mm. So, like, I worked at Bandai Namco, and, like, they have a CEO of Pac-Man who owns basically the rights to the Pac-Man IP. So, like, if you wanted to do something with Pac-Man, it wasn't just as easy as, like, oh, we're just going to use Pac-Man because it's part of our company. You still had have to go through a process. So it's possible that that's a scenario that, that happened. It's possible that it isn't, but, like, there's a lot more things that people don't necessarily see behind the scenes that make some of these even harder to deal with in the long run.
The role of a museum and an archive these days, I find, is dual. It's both digital and physical. And the digital being like those scans that you mentioned, emulations of old games that are hard to find or out of that. Can you speak a little bit to the physical part of your collection and how that can grow over time?
Yeah, so where I started, I started from a research aspect. So I was working on teaching game history courses at the Art Institute at the time, later in LaSalle. And basically I was like, okay, I want some things physically to represent some of the things I was teaching. So I started with research and then looking at companies, but then I was like, okay, well, but like if I'm teaching an era, it would be nice to like bring in a console to show them what that would look like physically. So I started picking up game consoles here and there, and so now I have a collection of over 50 game consoles from all over the spectrum, which is hopefully going to be transitioned over to the museum once we have a physical space. Because it takes up a lot of space in my house. I think that the physicality of the medium is something that is missing from a lot of things today.
Agreed.
And it's something that, like, people get really attached to the physical part. When you ask somebody, like, what do you remember about, like, games from your past? A lot of people remember, like, playing with a specific console. Like, the games, they remember, and they like them. But, like, it's to get that feeling back, it's really about, like, holding that controller and stuff like that. So we're looking at that. We're trying to find ways to kind of bring that back. It's obviously a bit of a challenge, especially when you have consoles from like the 70s, that plastic gets brittle over time.
Absolutely. Good old Bakelite.
Exactly. And so you can't just have people like handling these things freely anymore. Like, some museums are trying to do that, but you have to be pretty careful with it. And like, there is a limited supply to some degree. Now, some were mass quantities, whatever, but even so. So we're trying to find ways that we can kind of, we've been taking really high-quality scans to use in our digital components, but we want to eventually turn that back towards physical so that we can have physical reconstructions that are like one-to-one with the original so that we can give people a hands-on experience with it, because it's so important to, like, you don't really get a sense of how that thing really played at the time without giving somebody that controller, especially today where you get a lot of like emulation, but the emulation usually is running still on like an Xbox controller or something like that. You're not really seeing what that thing felt like at the time. And so that's, I think, a big piece that's missing. And when you look at, especially in the emulation scene, something that we looked at early on, there's no controllers from like the second, like what Wikipedia currently calls the second generation, which I also disagree with the classification. There's a lot of like other generations really that happened. But anyways, long story short, in that era from the Atari 2600 and Fairchild Channel F kind of all the way up through to the end of the ColecoVision.
Yep.
We have like several different types of controllers that showed up. The early ones that are like the Atari.
Yeah.
Some of those still exist. We still have like a joystick, right? Yeah. But when you get towards that, like, we have dial pads and things added into the controllers, you cannot find like a USB version of that today.
No.
So if you're trying to replicate that experience, it's really hard. Like, I've tried a couple of different things, and I'm like, now considering we just build our own for display purposes and stuff like that, but like, it's it's a really huge challenge right now.
It brings in 3D printing and soldering and adapters and dongles. Yeah,
exactly.
It's good times.
They're all skill sets that like I have a small amount of, but it's one of those things that like we're currently not funded, so we're still like trying to build that up. Over time, I'd love to get an engineer to like just be in-house so we can do a lot more of that stuff, but it's, yeah.
For people who want to support the project and find out where you are, where can people find you on the internet and in person?
Yeah, so we have a domain, cvgm.ca, which stands for Canadian Video Game Museum.ca. We will be doing that Museum of Vancouver installation for a few months from, like 2 weeks from now for a few months, and then hopefully we will create a physical space from that. We also are active relatively on Instagram as well with, I think it's under at CVGM or at Canadian Video Game Museum, one of the two. I can't remember at the top of my head. But yeah, that's how you can reach me for now.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Let's keep on preserving history.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is your host for the hour, Danny Nesvedarani. And what you just heard was an interview from our music coordinator, Connor. And it was an interview that he did with the Canadian Video Game Museum. Very cool stuff. But that wasn't the only interview he did. He actually did quite a few other ones. But this one is a very interesting one. So it is with the developers of a game by the name of Kinetoscape. A game that has been released on none other than the Atari 7800. Yeah, that's right, the Atari 7800. When I was told that, I was like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? But no, this game was specifically developed in the modern era for the Atari 7800. Wow. All right, hope you enjoy this interview with the developer of the video game, the Atari 7800 video game, Kinetoscape.
Again, everybody, welcome back to the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo. We're on the third floor with some of my table mates and neighbors here just outside the theater. They have a new Atari 7800 games. And for Radioland, can you introduce yourself and what you've done behind the project and the name of the project, please?
Hey, I'm Brent Bouchard. I'm the one of the designers and the programmers, I guess, for the new game called Kinetoscape for the 7800. I'm programming it in Atari 7800 Basic, and we got a little bit of a demo here at the show. I'll toss it over to Tom here for the rest.
Hey there, I'm Tommy McKenna. I'm co-founder of Zapped Interactive with Brent Bouchard, and we, as mentioned, are working on Kinetoscape, a Metroidvania-style game for the 7800. My position on the game has been as kind of gameplay developer. Like I've created the map of the game and some of the interactions
and sprite designer and level designer
and many beers for many game dev conversations.
As all good game dev goes, the 7800 I feel doesn't get enough love that it deserves. A lot of people know of the other classic consoles, the 2600 and so on, but the 7800, again, a massive advancement in technology. What are some of the advancements you found? Because we talked briefly about how some of the early development was modeled after older Atari consoles, but now you've changed scope to the 7800.
Yeah, because for me, the 7800 was the system I had growing up. I had a lot of 2600 games, 7800 games. All my friends had the Nintendo, of course, but I was stuck with my 7800 games, but I fell in love with the system. Later in life, I learned that it actually had more processing power than I realized. So we wanted to kind of push those limits and try to make something, you know, with multiple levels and an ending and maybe an intro and sound, you know. Bar was kind of low, but that was what we were shooting for, and that's what we're striving with this game anyway.
Can you speak to the either advancements or limitations of the 7800 for things like level design and memory storage?
Yeah. So when we first set out, Brent had did some look, you know, design sort of research, and we saw that games were able to do a lot of progressive things, like having a game system where you're moving from one room to another, finding things, and then going back, and you know, much like a Metroid game, but in a very simplistic way. So when we started rolling it out, it seemed like we were going to be able to do a bunch of stuff. And so initially, we pumped out a map of the game that was in excess of 260 or 70 rooms, separate rooms. And as we moved through and figured out some of the limitations of memory and how that was going to constrict us, we ended up knocking the game down to 106 separate unique screens with different assets involved. And so it was a huge balancing act between how many characters you could have on screen at the ratio that we chose to go with, which we have fairly large characters as opposed to a lot of Atari games. We are working on most of our characters around 32 pixels tall, which is pretty huge. Double most games. So that constricted us a fair bit in terms of what we could have on screen and how many screens we could have in progression.
For the actual, because you do have a physical cartridge here, could you speak a little bit to that manufacturing process? Because it's not like that console is readily available or the hardware to actually make those stuff is readily available.
Yeah, so we programmed it within the parameters that it was able to fit on a cartridge. That was our plan from the get-go. We just wanted to get this thing on a cart. I suppose we could have possibly programmed it larger only to fit on a ROM, but we wanted to make sure it was made for a cart. And then we were in talks with a developer who was able to take what we did, the data file, and they know someone somewhere who was able to make a cartridge, you know. So they helped us do that. That was outside of our scope, but the point is we programmed it to fit on the cart, and it did fit on the cart so far, this demo we have. So we're happy about that anyway.
So good. For some of the... is this your first project on the Atari 7800 and the first project for the company?
This is our first ever video game. This is Brent's first endeavor into coding of any sort. And it was my first game development situation. So yeah, a lot of hallmarks for us here.
Amazing. I also see a lot of wonderful like prints and merch and T-shirts. I really like that black, the blue and white one a lot. I'm going to have to grab me one of those. Do you guys have a timeline for... I know we're doing kind of a public beta test right now. Do you have a timeline for when this game would be available? And also, would it be available just on a 7800 cartridge, or would it be that plus emulation or anything in that realm?
Yeah, I think the idea is cartridge for sure. On the website, I imagine, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a ROM that you can play on a 7800 emulator. We would love to get it on Steam. I don't know if we can, but I know there is other 7800 games on Steam, so we haven't really looked into that, but I'd love that for accessibility. And then as far as like merch and posters and T-shirts, because Tom and I both work in animation professionally, we just love the art form. You know, anytime I could get posters made and T-shirts, I love that stuff. That's just side passion, you know.
I got toques made this year. It was fun. Good times.
Yeah, it makes you feel visceral, right?
Yeah. It takes it from... video games are interesting. I was talking with someone with the Canadian Video Game Museum about how so much of the experience of gaming and the connection is attached to that physical side of things. And I think a cartridge is one of the greatest ways to do that, because that's really where home video game and consoles started and exploded from.
Absolutely. I think people create new memories and excitement in the actual adventure of playing a video game, and you end up wanting a tactile connection to that thing. You don't need to be playing it all the time, but you want to be remembering it. T-shirt, poster, cartridge that you can pick up, box art, manual that you can flip through. It's a real adventure. And to your question earlier about releases, presently we've got about 50% of the game actually programmed and built out. But we are hoping to have the entire game finished by the end of the year, end of 2026, and potentially having the first batch of cartridges available for purchase on Atari Age sometime in early 2027.
Amazing.
With potential for those downloadable ROMs somewhere in the same area or closely following.
Wonderful. And where can people find your stuff on the internet, social media, anything like that?
We have some of the early demos available that can be downloaded and played from the forums on Atari Age. Brent, you follow me out. Like, your Instagram probably is a good place to find connections to.
Yeah, or websites, or just places where Radioland can go to find your guys' stuff.
Yeah, I have some stuff on my personal Instagram. We are bad with promotion, but we should get a designated...
I understand that. Make the account.
Yeah, I do want to get a designated like Instagram or a YouTube page. We don't have that yet. We're sort of just piggybacking off our personal accounts, but right now we have like a support page, you know, like a with some game info on it, which I could link to you guys.
Absolutely,
at Vancouver.
Yes. Yep.
But that's all we have right now. Yeah.
Sweet.
Because we're bad at that.
Amazing stuff. Thank you guys so much. Everyone, when it's out, go check out Kinetiscape. Or if you find yourself at the Retro Gaming Expo, which Radioland might, but enjoy some 7800 glory.
Cool.
Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You're tuned in to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much to Connor and for everyone at the Retro Gaming Expo for those interviews. Coming up next, we have a piece coming from CHLY in Nanaimo, BC, from fellow LJI journalist Lauren McKenzie. Hope you enjoy.
This is a CHLY News Update. More than 60 years after a fire ravaged Nanaimo's final Chinatown, the Nanaimo Chinatown Heritage Foundation is working to save what is left. When Sharon Su, chair of the Heritage Foundation, first moved to Nanaimo in 2020, she couldn't believe Nanaimo had not just one, but four Chinatowns. This led to her researching more about the Chinese communities that once found culture and connection in what's now part of downtown.
But the astonishing thing to me is that Nanaimo at one point, this Chinatown was so vibrant. It had like an opera house. It had all these businesses. It had a Chinese school. So it was like a complete community.
According to the city of Nanaimo, the first of four Chinatowns was built in the 1860s during an influx of Chinese immigrants seeking work in the coal mine industry on Vancouver Island. The original Chinatown featured residences, stores, and restaurants. 20 years later, as more and more people came to the harbor city to work in the mines, the Chinese community was pushed to find a new location further away from downtown. Three subsequent Chinatowns were built as the community was pushed further away from downtown and towards the South End. When the Chinese Immigration Act, commonly known as the Chinese Exclusion Act, was passed in 1923, Chinese immigration was halted. The act remained in place until 1947, ending just after the Second World War. With the coal mining industry also starting to dwindle, many residents of the last Chinatown left to work elsewhere in the province. The remaining Chinatown soon became derelict, and a fire on September 30th of 1960 burnt down almost all that remained. Sue thought the fire meant there was nothing left of the history of the area, until she decided to do some research into it.
Well, I was looking for any evidence of the Nanaimo Chinese in the Chinatown, and then by just randomly looking online and looking for anything, any reference to Nanaimo's Chinese, this building popped up at 880 Heckett. And I looked at it and I'm like, oh my goodness, it has, if that's the Chinatown, there's still buildings?
This inspired her to learn more about the history of the building and the former Chinatowns. She discovered through her research that the building at 880 Heckett Street was built in the last Chinatown in 1955, just a few years before the fire. It was used as a multi-purpose space as well as a meeting location for Nanaimo's Chinese Freemasons. Only a block away from 880 Heckett Street, she discovered a second building that was originally part of Nanaimo's third Chinatown. 997 Heckett Street, now used for rental housing, was built in 1930 to be used by the Chinese Freemasons before they moved to the 880 Heckett Street location. On top of looking online and through archives, Sue has been attending several farmers markets in the area with the Nanaimo Chinatown Heritage Foundation to speak with people who may remember the Chinatowns.
So there's this outpouring of people's memories, which is so amazing. And just even about like the simple things. The First Nations man told me, he's like, oh yeah, I used to go to the Chinatown. I'd get this octopus. I didn't know what to do with it. So I'd bring it to Chinatown. Somebody would cook it for me. He's like, yeah, we had good relationships. He said, yeah, I'm an elder. I don't fish anymore. But of course I